We're very excited to have the David Weatherly with us tonight. He's the author of The Black Eyed Children. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Absolutely. David, why don't you tell us a little bit about the lecture you gave in Santa Paula, California a few weeks ago on the tulpas.
The tulpas are basically a collected energy that can take physical. So in ancient Tibetan traditions, the idea was that through a series of meditations and focused energy, a mental collection of energy could become physically formed. So it was a process where it would look like a ghost or a spirit, and eventually it would become more solidified.
Wow.
Until it became fully formed in the physical realm.
Well, you know, I was there in the audience that day in Santa Paula when you were giving the lecture at Ghost Town, which was the event that was put on by Bill Murphy and his wife Anita. And, you know, I got to tell you, it was an amazing lecture. What I found most interesting is that from your lecture, what it showed me was not just how powerful the human mind is at manifesting these entities out of pure thought, but that it somehow shows that it could possibly have this, you know, connection to frequencies that resonate and manipulate the human mind. We know that the mind is affected by frequency manipulation. You know, that goes all the way back to Wilhelm Reich and whatnot. But your lecture kind of put the pieces together for a lot of us who looked into, you know, HARP, Project Bluebeam. It was just amazing. It was just amazing, and I want to give you kudos for that. And I'm so excited that you're going to be giving that same lecture to the attendees of SAC UFOCon. How do you feel about, you know, a lot of the emerging rumors that are coming about that there's technologies that exist whereby these systems are in place, you know, these technological systems are in place to send out frequencies to, you know, like these exotic metals, you know, that are possibly, you know, not even, you know, earth-based metals, you know, these are, they operate in the biomimetic principle that by through these frequencies, they can, you know, change their shape and, perform certain functions. You know, do you see a connection to that and the human mind's ability to manipulate frequency and manifest these entities?
Oh, sure. Now, I haven't looked into the technical aspects a lot when it comes to some of the emerging technology of the mind being able to control mechanical devices. But basically, it's the same principles. I mean, if we go back to these ancient shamanic cultures, really, we can transfer a lot of what they were doing into current technology and start to understand what these people knew for thousands of years. And, you know, it's a very basic principle that our minds create energy. And that's something that virtually all ancient cultures have talked about for, you know, hundreds of years. So what we're seeing now is an emergence of applying these ancient traditions and ideas into technological concepts. So it doesn't surprise me at all that that's starting to emerge.
Yeah, you know, recently my 14-year-old son had asked me about psychokinetic abilities, telekinesis, and, you know, a friend of mine had recommended a book that I buy for him by an author by the name of Herbie Brennan. And I bought several books from Herbie Brennan, and one of the books that came in was a ghost hunting book that I had actually picked up for my younger son, my 12-year-old son. He was interested in ghost hunting with me because, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but I actually have a group that's called Umbra Paranormal. If you go to umbraparanormal.com, you can find out what that group is about. That's a ghost team that essentially I work with on the weekends, in addition to the UFO research that I do. But when I was reading this book with my son, there's a section in there, and you got to keep in mind that this book was written for more of a teenage audience. There's a section in there called How to Make a Real Ghost. And Herbie Brennan, essentially, just briefly, there's just three so short paragraphs, but he delves into the distinguished French academic and traveler who you spoke about in your lecture, Madame Alexandra David Neal. And he talked about, you know, how she had manifested through her through the teachings that she received there in Tibet, this monk. And I thought that was just the most amazing aspect of your lecture. Because, I mean, unlike this book, your lecture really gave a deep overview of Alexandra David Neal and the work that she did. And again, it was just something that was very exciting for the audience that day, because I could tell you at least 90% of that audience had never heard of the term tulpa, let alone the fact that humans had this ability to manifest entities out of pure thought. So thank you so much for that lecture, and I can't wait to hear it again up here in Northern California in June.
Oh, yeah, and it's interesting because Alexandra Neal, her story, first of all, she was a phenomenal woman, and it's surprising how few people know about her. She traveled the world. She went into Tibet when it was essentially the Forbidden Kingdom. Westerners weren't even allowed in the country, let alone a Western woman. So the things that she did were just amazing. And she did have a very intense experience where she, first of all, she encountered what she was told were tulpas, and through encountering that tulpa, she went to the Brahmins and learned exactly what these beings were. And then she proceeded to learn the Brahmins to create one. That's a pretty amazing story.
Wow, that's amazing. I can't wait to hear that again. Hey, David, thank you so much for being our guest tonight. If you could please hold on a little bit for the panel that's going to be coming up shortly. What I need to do now is I need to transition into our next guest. So thank you, David. I thank you very much for being on the show with us tonight.
Sure. Thanks, Andy.
Yep. Okay, so let's go ahead and transition into our next guest, probably the best-looking guest of tonight. Just kidding. I'm just going to Scotty Roberts. Scotty is the co-founder and publisher of Intrepid Magazine, a publication with an eclectic focus on science, politics, culture, ancient civilizations, UFOs and aliens, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, and we might as well add underwater basket weaving. Scotty is the former editor-in-chief of TAPS Para Magazine, which is the official publication of Sci-Fi's Ghost Hunters television show, this highly rated television show. Scotty, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Anthony. And hey, you don't know the untapped market for underwater basket weaving.
Well, I realized that, you know, Intrepid Magazine, unlike most magazines, covers a lot. So I just wanted to get that in there. But, Scotty, you know, a lot of people are excited about your new book, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. And, you know, recently you were on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. And I got to tell you, that was probably, it will have to be one of the highest rated shows of the year. I got so many emails because you had mentioned me on the show, and I kept getting these emails. I'm like, what the hell is all this about? And it was you. Everybody was saying, wow, you know, Scotty just did a phenomenal job. You know, he went out of his way to really explain to the listener in layman's terms a lot of these highbrow, you know, theological terms that just most of us, including myself, just don't really get, you know, when we're looking at it from an academic perspective. So thank you for that. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to delve into Genesis a little bit with you, and just to get a brief feedback from you on a couple of questions I have. In Genesis 6:1-4, it says that the sons of God, or we know, you know, from the just from the short contextual, you know, right up that's there, it says that the sons of God are captivated by the beauty of the daughters of men. And we learned that these sons of God, they marry them, they have sex with them, producing offspring, which are giants known as the Nephilim. And Genesis also goes on to say that these Nephilim were mighty men, they were men of renown. You know, these are some terms I was hoping that you could fill in for us, the gaps, you know, some of us don't understand the meaning of those. What do they mean by mighty men and men of renown?
Sure. Well, first thing I want to say about this is the interesting thing I found is I went to the theological study first because that was my background. But in studying, as many people who've studied any of these things know, you've got over 600 different ancient tribal cultures and religions that mention these types of beings connected to major flood accounts of ancient days and common threads to all of them. One of the most common threads being some sort of non-human or spirit entity intermingling with I don't know why I was restricted to just the daughters of men, but the daughters of men, and bequeathing a race that some higher power or some deity needed mm-hmm. to destroy by way of a flood. And that's the basis of the story. If it were just found in Genesis alone, you could go, that's just a Hebrew legend. Mm-hmm. But the Hebrew book of Genesis is really simply another version of this story that's found in many, many, many different places.
Sure.
The sons of God in the Hebrew, known as the Bene HaElohim, they are the ones who descended down, it says in the book of Genesis, and intermingled with the daughters of Adam in the Hebrew. Again, a stark mm-hmm. contrast made. I remember when I was in seminary back many, many years ago, again, you talked mm-hmm. about being dated in your age. Mm-hmm. This would have been back when there was still black and white TV. not quite that far back. But my seminary professors, some of them, because I was in a very conservative fundamentalist setting, would tell me, that's just the sons of the men who ran the schools of the prophets up on the hillside, and they'd come down into the valley and intermingle with the common folk mm-hmm. and had children by them. I said, well, then why is there a stark contrast made in the Hebrew in the context there? Why are they the sons or the Bene HaElohim versus the daughters of Adam? Why weren't they both called children of Adam and then spelled out a different way? So that's your first clue that something's going on there.
Okay, so I ask you this then, Scotty. So sons of God, daughters of men, what sort of beings were these? Were they human, or did they belong to an alien species of off-world origins? Is that a possibility, the sons of God?
That they were off-world origins? Yeah, I distinctly think they were. I believe they were. When I say that the book of Genesis, now, mind you, I come out of that theology. That's where I was for many years of mm-hmm. my life. So when I say this, I'm not saying it lightly. I believe the Hebrew version in the book of Genesis is simply that. It is a version of this story. And you find this story in many different cultures and many mm-hmm. different religions. Mm-hmm. I like to quote, because it's a favorite of mine, because I'm a Welsh Scotsman, I like to quote the Celtic version as a great example of this. The Tuatha De Danann, or the children of the goddess Danu, they were known as the bright, shining kings who descended from heaven and intermingled with humans and also brought forbidden knowledges, which reflects many of the stories that are out there. And once again, you've got these, they're known as bright and shining. Many references in the Old Testament, the Book of Enoch, as to the bright, shining characters who came down and impregnated human women. Enoch refers to them as the Watchers. They off-world? You got as much proof as that these were off-world aliens or extraterrestrials as you do mm-hmm. that they were just God-breathed angels or something like that. That's the problem with any of this. There's no real hardcore proof. The proof that I go by is mm-hmm. you can apply some modicum of the scientific method to this by saying there was a multiplicity of cultures that told the same stories in common threads with different characters, differing events, but they said the same thing. That creates that sort of scientific methodology that can be applied to all of this, is that it's there, it's anthropological, it's archaeological, it's historical.
And that's what I refer to in my book, UFO Highway, and the human origin section, as that strong lineal traditional connection.
Yes.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, when I was writing UFO Highway, when I was delving into the human origin aspect, I was thinking about that whole, aspect of this union between the sons of God and the daughters of men. And I remember coming across this writing from Philastrius, who was the bishop of Brescia. He had wrote a catalog of heresies, and one of the ideas that he said that was ludicrous, and in fact he said would have been impossible, was that how when you interpret that the sons of God as these fallen angels were enticed by these beautiful women of earth and began lusting after them, the literal wording of the Bible, considering the fact that these were angelics, people like Philastrius of that time considered these angelics to be non-physical beings and therefore could not have engaged in sexual relationships with women from earth. Is that right?
That's where I think he went wrong in the first place, and many people went wrong, is that the Hebrew word for angel never exists in any of these texts. They're not called that at all. But you go to Psalm 82, and I know you've got to jump off of me here pretty soon and on to somebody else, but let me throw this in. Psalm 82, read that. It talks about a group known as the Divine Council and Elohim, the God among many gods, referring to them as gods in heaven. So, if, by the way, if you want to get controversial about it, the Bible doesn't teach monotheism. If you go back to the original languages in which it's written and look at the
very
context.
Very much polytheism, that's right.
Right, and they are called the bright shining princes of heaven.
Wow.
Just like the Celts called the Tuatha, the bright shining kings from heaven. And they weren't writing the book of Genesis, they were writing from a Celtic angle. So these similar beings existed, and you're not going to find the word angel existing anywhere. So they weren't spirit beings in that sense. They were corporeal in form.
Wow. Hey, Scotty, thank you so much for that. You know, that's a lot of information in a little bit of time, but I know that the audience got a lot. So thank you for being on the show. And listen, hang in there for a few minutes. We have to transition over to Micah Hanks. And again, so thank you, Scotty. And
Micah Hanks?
Yes, Micah Hanks.
Micah Hanks, bring him on. The one, the only, the Micah, the Hanks.
Okay, so hang in there, Scotty. We'll be back in a few minutes for the panel. And okay, so my next guest is Micah Hanks, who is a full-time journalist, a radio personality, a musician, an author, and investigator of the unexplained. Throughout his many years studying the world's mysteries, Hanks has visited a number of places collecting information about not only aliens and UFOs, but also cultural data, folklore, and reports of strange creatures like Sasquatch. He also spent a number of years working with various scientists, historians, and film crews, particularly fellow researcher and friend Joshua P. Warren, who many of you know, attempting to solve the mystery of the Brown Mountain Lights. Hanks has been featured as a guest on many television and radio programs, including the History Channel's Guts and Bolts show, Travel Channel's Weird Travels, CNN Radio, and the Jeff Rentz program. He is also a staff writer for UFO magazine, Mysterious Universe, and a regular contributor to Intrepid magazine. That's our friend Scotty Roberts magazine. So again, I'd like to welcome Micah Hanks. Micah, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Anthony. It's my pleasure to be here with you tonight. And, you know, as a matter of fact, I might as well go ahead and just put this out there. You know, Scotty and I, we work very closely together. I'm actually operating in an editorial function with Intrepid Magazine these days. So, you know, I've been promoted. And I tell you, there's nobody in the world to save maybe yourself that I'd like to work that closely with. Scotty is absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I also just have to say, man, how do you follow somebody like him?
Yeah, Scotty's a one of a kind. Hey, listen, Micah, why don't you tell our audience about Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule? That's just a fantastic book, and I want to see if you could briefly tell the audience what it encompasses.
Well, yeah, sure. And for me, doing anything briefly is very difficult because as I'm known, at least throughout my region and among my own listenership of my program, the Graylian Report, I am the mouth of the South. No matter what Ted Turner may say, I am indeed the man who's laid claim to the title. That said, to try and condense this concept into the most important criteria, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule is a study of what happens when human beings enter altered states of consciousness. And there are three general varieties that I discuss in that book, which are, of course, magical practices and ritual, mystical processes, meditation, things like that, and then also the kind of induced reaction that we have to hallucinogenic substances and entheogens. Those three things comprise the content in Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, and unlike a lot of researchers, I'm not putting all these together to try and create what you might call a grand unified theory that unites all paranormal phenomena or the unexplained. I don't think that we have all the answers, and that in terms of what human perception will allow, that we will ever really have all those answers, at least in this life. But I'll tell you this, that I think that there are indeed certain connections and parallels that can be drawn, and I approach it, as you kind of said in the introduction, primarily as, you know, a folklorist or as a philosopher from that perspective. Again, I'm not someone who's going to tell you that that all these strange phenomena that we experience in this life, all these strange experiences that we have, are entirely physical or entirely real in the sense of how, you know, humans perceive real physical reality. I think a lot of it is symbolic. I think that there's a lot of subversive things that may mean kind of, you know, or subliminal things, I think would be a better way to describe it, that affect us individually and that they may not have that meaning for others. And so that's just part of the quest that is life, you know, finding that sense of meaning.
Well, Mike, I've been sitting on a question for a long time because I've not met a person who I felt could adequately answer this question, but you, my friend, I think you could be the person that could give me the type of feedback that I'm seeking. When I look at these modern-day musicians like David Blaine and Chris Angel, and I see some of the things that they perform, you know, it makes me wonder, you know, as a skeptic of the whole magical, you know, phenomena, you know, because, you know, I see Penn and Teller. I see, you know, they do these tricks or whatever, and then they show you exactly how they do it. But I'm telling you, there's stuff that David Blaine and Chris Angel do that, for me, you know, when you're talking about magic and mysticism and consciousness, and do you think that it's possible that individuals like that could have possibly tapped into another level of consciousness and this ability to manipulate the physical, and that's what gives them this great ability to perform such you know, tremendous feats? What is your opinion on that?
My opinion on that is that yes and no. I don't think that individuals like David Blaine, for instance, are literally you know, manipulating matter in a way that most people cannot. They are not mutants or magicians in that sense, sorcerers. Mm-hmm. I think that, again, you know, obviously what they're doing is a form of showmanship. It's misdirection. To quote John Travolta's character from the film Swordfish, the eyes see, the mind believes. And that is very true, because what the eyes see, the mind believes. I think that we have to take into consideration that a variety of unexplained phenomena witnessed by people and experienced in our lives are probably the result of misinterpretation of known phenomena we observe, and then the mind interprets that, again, in a way that may be symbolic and representative of something on a deeper spiritual level to us as individuals, and therefore we take from that a spiritual or profound experience that some might deem paranormal. Now, that said, we also take for granted what role we as individuals and what role human perception on an individual basis plays in what constitutes our reality. And therefore, if we perceive something as being spiritual, magical, unexplained, or even otherworldly, there is, I think, in a certain capacity on an individual level, whether this be, you know, physical, psychological, or otherwise, there is something that affects us as individuals, and that, in a sense, I think, can have the capacity to actually constitute in some way, shape, or form a version of reality. This especially occurs on the quantum level. You know, when we observe certain particles, especially photons, and they can behave either as, for instance, a waveform or a single particle. So we have a lot of strange little variables, and perception seems to be at the root of it. We don't understand that entirely, but in that sense, yes, I think that human ability to perceive is flawed, and therefore when we perceive certain things, the perception of a mystery alone could constitute that mystery itself.
And within that same vein, much like with David Weatherly talking about this tulpa effect and this ability for humans to literally, you know, channel their powers within their mind and focus hard enough to manifest these entities out of pure thought. That's interesting. Wow, Micah, thank you so much. I hate to cut you off, Micah, but I need to transition into my next guest, Mr. Jay Weiner. So, Micah, thank you so much, and you adequately and aptly answered those questions well enough that such that we understood. But I gotta say, Jesus Christ, how many degrees do you have? What kind of doctorates do you have? In you're very well spoken, my man, and you made us understand very succinctly. So thank you, Micah, and we're glad to have you at SAC UFO Con. I know people, many people are excited. As a matter of fact, I had a couple who bought tickets from England who are excited about meeting you. So that's something I thought I'd share with you.
How awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to being out there, too. And that said, I'll abstain and allow you to go on to the next guest.
All right, and stay put for the panel, which will be happening very shortly after the break. So I'm going to transition into our next and final guest, many of whom you know, Mr. Jay Weidner. Jay is just an amazing individual. I got to tell you, this year I was on a live stream with Carrie Cassidy of Project Camelot, and she had paired me with probably one of the most amazing individuals that I have met in this whole field of the conspiratorial. Wired Magazine has called Jay Weidner an authority on the hermetic and alchemical alchemy traditions. Sorry about that. I got tongue-tied. And one of the things that I'd like to first delve into, well, first of all, Jay, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for being here.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice. Many of us know that you're a renowned author, this a fantastic filmmaker, and this hermetic scholar. You know, I have some questions that I had put together for you, Jay. Most people are just now learning about the work that you have done on the archons with respect to the Nag Hammadi codices. I have been going on radio recently, and I've been telling people about your work. And I got to say, number one, there's a huge audience out there that is very familiar with you, especially for the works that you have done in the film industry. Kubrick's Odyssey, it's just an amazing film. You have a new film that's going to be coming out this year called Shasta. Before we delve into the archons, can you tell us a little bit about this new film, Shasta?
Yeah, it's a feature film with real actors and a real story, and I think it's pretty good. And it's a story, well, actually I got started about 30 years ago. I was reading some ancient Vedic texts, and I found a prophecy. And the prophecy said that right near the end of the cycle, the 10th avatar of Vishnu, the Buddha is the 9th avatar, so you know where we're coming from here.
Yes.
The 10th avatar of Vishnu, whose name is Kalki, will come to Earth, and he will destroy the enemies of truth. So for 30 years, I've been waiting for Kalki to come, and he never came. So I decided that I would just make a movie of him coming, and maybe that would get the whole thing started.
Oh, so goodness.
The movie is, it's about the return of Kalki. And, you know, how does Kalki destroy the enemies of truth without resorting to violence? And that was really the trick of the screenplay, I guess.
Wow.
And I think I achieved it. So it'll be out in September, and I think people are going to like it.
I think people are going to love it. You know, when we met, Jay, shortly after we met through Carrie Cassidy, I went out and purchased the Nag Hammadi scriptures, the revised and updated translation by Marvin Meyer, and the complete sacred Gnostic text. And I have been delving in deeply into these, and specifically the paraphrase of Shem, which I'm sure you're familiar with. There was some really interesting stuff in there. There was this one passage where it said, "The spirit discovers the evil root, and his light becomes entangled with the mind of darkness, the first mind." And then later on it says, "For the spirit made use of every form of darkness, because he had appeared in his greatness." When I think of terms like form of darkness, and when I listen to you tell us about these archons, and to me, it's almost as if the archons have made it such that throughout time, they have carefully architected our society such that by default, we worship them. And I know about the archons, but many of the people listening don't know about the archons, So, let alone be hard-pressed to define it, those of us that know what an archon is. Why don't you tell the audience what is an archon?
Well, now, that's a big question. An archon is, the Nag Hammadi, I'll just tell you what they say. The Nag Hammadi says that they're like us, but they don't have our essence. And they duplicate reality to fool us into doing exactly what you just said, into getting us to, by default, worship them and think that they're our saviors. And by doing that, we give our power to them and make them strong and thereby also make ourselves weak. Now, the thing about the Nag Hammadi, which is so important, is that it was found in clay jars in Egypt in 1945, and nobody's been able to mess with these texts. No popes, no kings, nobody. We have it straight as they wanted us to read it. And they're telling us that the Earth is being invaded by an off-planet species named the Archons, who encourages us into violence and war, and that basically we are their slaves. And that's a pretty shocking thing coming from people 2,000 plus years ago. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the evidence that we see today manifested before us, a lot of the stuff that you, Anthony, have been finding, we can see that this message from 2,100 years ago actually is more credible now than ever. And if you think about it, the real answer to a lot of our problems is that we're actually facing an off-planet entity who's outsmarting us, and that's the Archon.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for that. You know, there's a lot of people behind this message that at the end of 2012 or shortly thereafter, ET is coming to save us from ourselves. But, you know, Jay, I got to tell you, because everything I know, especially from the work that I've studied, much like your own, you know, I delved deeply into the a lot of the transcripts from conversations that you had with people like Jeff Rentz. You know, it tells me that these Archons, they're out to destroy us or enslave us. They're not coming to save us. Am I right?
No, and I think you are right. I'd be very dubious about any aliens coming to save us, and it would be something more like that scene from The Twilight Zone, To Serve Man, where the aliens are coming to kill us and acting like they're coming to save us. And so I'd be very dubious about any of that. I think we're caught in a situation here, which, you know, which is sort of a prison planet, and but we can get out. There are recipes for how to get out of the Archon control, which I'll be addressing at the conference, and I believe that this Archon problem is the worst problem that we face on Earth right now. We don't even know who we are. We don't know what we possess. We don't know how much wealth we really have, because the Archons have been stealing it from us for three, four, five, longer thousands of years than that.
Oh, my goodness.
I think that's,
Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, do you feel that it's possible that the Archons not only reside here on Earth, but that they can also occupy the moon or Mars? And here's the reason why I ask. Because we have evidence of past civilizations on both locations. For instance, there are two critical pieces of compelling evidence of where perfectly rectangular upright structures found in images from NASA are on Mars, related, are on Mars or on the moon of Mars in Phobos. These bear a striking resemblance to the monoliths planted on Earth and on the moon by aliens in the classic sci-fi film 2001: A Space Odyssey. So you have the monoliths, and then there are the pyramids associated with both Mars and the moon again. I mean, for instance, in one of the reflections of the Apollo astronaut's visor, I forget which astronaut it is, it clearly shows a pyramid. When you enhance the photo and you look into the visor, you can clearly see that he's staring at a pyramid. And we also know of the D&E pyramid of Cydonia on Mars. But I ask you, do you believe that, you know, much to the effect that the Nag Hammadi says that these Archons are lurking in various planets within our solar system. What do you feel about them lurking on the moon or in Mars? And after you answer that, we're going to be transitioning out to a break. But go ahead.
I definitely think that they're occupying the moon and Mars, and a lot more the planets, the moons of Saturn, and a lot more the rings of Saturn. I think we can see occupation vehicles in. So yeah, they're occupying the solar system, and they're trapping us, and they're tapping, they're using us for energy, food, and some kind of soul harvesting.
Wow, and I think that it's interesting that a lot of that symbolism played out in Stanley Kubrick's movie 2001: A Space Odyssey, and you're the person, you know, that gave us Kubrick's Odyssey, which is documentary, which showed what? Which showed us the symbolism contained therein, you know, within the work of it, you know, within the man's work. And I think it's not by coincidence that in 2001: A Space Odyssey we see these monoliths, and today we're finding monoliths on both the moons, the moon of Mars and Mars itself. Hey, Jay, thank you so much for being my guest. Stay put. We're going to transition out to a break, and when we come back, we're going to delve into some other questions as part of a panel where everybody will get to chime in. And I want to remind Scotty, Micah, Lyle, and David, and yourself, Jay, and Ed, feel free to chime in at any time when we come back into the panel. I'll set it up for us, and then we'll go from there. So we're going to go break, everybody. We'll be back in a few minutes.